Can a Belief in Reincarnation Be Reconciled with Mormon Doctrine? By Virginia Burgess.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to welcome you to Session 223, Can a Belief in Reincarnation Be Reconciled with Mormon Doctrine? By Virginia Burgess. I'd like to remind you that admission is by name tag or ticket only, so if you need to take care of that, we would appreciate you doing that. Virginia Burgess is a retired psychologist. She's worked as a counselor for Job Service for a number of years. She has a Bachelor of Science degree from Weber State University with majors in social science, composite major. She has a master's in science from the University of Utah, majoring in educational psychology. She has published a book, The Quest for Love and Self-Esteem, copyright 1976, second printing 1985. She's a former member of AMCAP, and maybe she'll explain what that is. She won a Counselor of the Year award from Job Service in 1974. She is married, has 5 children, 20 grandchildren. Her husband is Ordith W. Burgess. So without further ado, we'll turn the time over to Virginia.
Well, good morning. It doesn't look like too many people were worried about reincarnation, but we'll get it on tape in case somebody else gets curious. Are there any of you here that have never experienced deja vu? The French term for a feeling that something that's happening in your life has happened before. There's a song about it. Something has happened for the first time. It may be a person you're meeting or a place or an event. There have been occasions throughout my life when I've had these experiences. I had always been able to simply conclude that I was remembering something from the pre-existence. And put it in the back of my mind without further investigation. For other Christians, this may not be so easy, as their doctrine, for other traditional Christians, I should say, because their doctrines teach against the pre-existence of spirits. In the spring of 1960, something occurred which I could not dismiss so easily, and it was so compelling that I was left with a lifelong desire to search for greater understanding of the mysteries. Before I take up the question of reincarnation, as it relates to Mormonism, I would like to try and describe the experience that happened to me in 1960, which I've learned to call a mystical experience. I was awakened by a voice announcing, "Today is the resurrection." I was sure this was the answer to my continuing prayers. I hurriedly dressed without waking my husband, and taking the car, I began a 3-mile drive to the cemetery. For the past 2 years, I had mourned without relief over the death of our 4-year-old daughter, Vicky. But if today is the resurrection, my problem was over. I was ecstatic. There had always been questions in the back of my mind about doctrines such as the resurrection, but there had never been a time when I was allowed to voice my concerns. As a fourth-generation Mormon, I had been taught that the second coming and the resurrection were events that we were always preparing for, as they were expected to happen in the very near future, even though there seemed to be no agreement as to what really was going to happen. I had grown up with a self-centered opinion that when tragedy strikes, it is some sort of punishment from God. It hadn't been hard for me to accept that idea when other people experienced grief in their lives, but now with Vicky's death, it was my turn, and my heart was broken. I had to accept the notion that God must be very angry with me if he would let this happen, and since her death, I had prayed constantly for understanding. But today was the resurrection, and I would have Vicky back. Nothing mattered now except that. It was a chilly morning in May, and the cemetery was dark and deserted as I drove in, got out of the car, and stood beside my child's grave waiting. It was so quiet, and as I looked around, I began to wonder why no one else was there. I also began to wonder what would be happening all over the world if the dead all returned today. The longer I stood there, the more troubled I became. I wanted to see Vicky desperately and hold her in my arms again. I'd missed her so much. However, I recognized many complications. There, close by, was the grave of a young husband. Since his death, his wife remarried and now had several children by her new husband. I wondered what was going to happen to them. The cemetery was full of these kinds of reminders. The idea of all of them returning today began to seem absurd. Still, I had been awakened by a voice, and there was no question in my mind about that. It was the first time anything like that had happened to me. Slowly, I made my way back to the car and began the drive home, while I kept asking myself over and over, what is happening today? I tried to remember the scriptures I knew about the resurrection. However, on my mission, I had such inner turmoil about the scriptures that I had quit studying altogether when I got home, so I wouldn't have any conflicts. So I hadn't studied since leaving the mission field 12 years earlier, so I could remember very little about the scriptures. All I could think of was scripture from the New Testament, Matthew 24 and 40. Then two shall be in the field, and one shall be taken and the other left. I began wondering what that could mean. Arriving home, I undressed and slipped quietly back into bed beside my sleeping husband as my mind continued to ask, what is the resurrection? And then began the experience that was to change my life forever. Gradually, I seemed to be entering another dimension where time and space as we normally experience them did not exist. By the way, has anyone seen the show Contact yet? It was that kind of experience. It was that kind. I mean, it was a new dimension passing through this long tunnel. And I'd never heard of it before. Wasn't prepared in any way, what shape or form. It was as though I had received an audience with God, and the answers I'd been seeking for so long were now available to me. I felt as though I was experiencing the great events in history about which I had questions. But I was a participant rather than a spectator. I was with Buddha under the banyan tree, with Moses on Mount Sinai, and with Jesus during the great events of his life. I came to realize that the resurrection I was experiencing was a spiritual, long-forgotten ancestral past. I believe Helaman 14 and 15 through 19 explains this kind of resurrection. I didn't bring my scriptures. I'll let you look that up if you want to. And by the way, I do have copies of my bibliographies. Any of you want to pick them up so you can see what I read to get this information. At the end of the 3 days, when my questions had been answered and my desire for understanding was satisfied, the vision closed. At last, I felt that I understood what personal revelation meant. And for the first time, I began to see meaning in the temple endowment ceremony, which had been such a mystery to me before. This spiritual journey seemed to touch every part of my life, and I at last felt at one with myself and sort of with God, but not completely. That took a lot more time. So great was the effect on my life, and in turn on the members of my family, I came to wonder if my daughter's whole purpose in life had been to prepare me for this event. My vision was sheer ecstasy, but the aftermath was devastating. I soon found out that I could not discuss my experiences with my husband or any of my friends, and I began to feel totally isolated and alone. I was faced all at once with reorienting my life and at the same time trying to understand more about what had happened to me. I will have to say here, someone told me to delete this, but I'm going to tell you, I was so disturbed by the experience I had to have psychiatric help. Now, if that means I'm a nut, okay, I did have psychiatric help and I got through it fine. I never spent any time in the hospital, nothing. He congratulated me on having this experience and it went well, but anyway. To find answers, I signed up for a class in religious philosophy. And during the next 10 years, went on to get a master's degree in psychology. From my religious philosophy class, I learned about mysticism and learned to identify with the mystics. Later, when I was exposed to the teachings of Carl Jung in one of my psychology classes, I found his concept of the collective unconscious a satisfying explanation of my experience. Later on, after I finished school and went to work as a counselor, I was resistant to a counselor. One of my co-workers introduced me to the concept of reincarnation. I was very resistant to this idea at first. But as my studies continued, I found in this concept a more complete explanation of my own experience. And I was surprised at the number of parallels I found with the teachings of the Mormon Church. It is these parallels I would like to present today for your consideration. Before I begin discussing the parallels, however, I would like to present a brief history of reincarnation that has become a part of Western thought. Reincarnation is an ancient idea. When Buddha spread his message through northern India around 500 BC, it was already an accepted idea among his contemporaries. Over the years, it has spread from India throughout most of Asia. And in many parts of the Orient, reincarnation is not considered a theory, but an established fact, almost like the law of gravity. Among the ancient Greek philosophers, it found adherence also. Plato speaks of it by quoting his teacher Socrates, who died in 399 BC, and supposedly referred to it as the ancient doctrine even then. Reincarnationists insist that their doctrine was taught by both Jesus and the early Christian church, and cite evidence from the Bible. In Matthew 17 and 11 through 13, we read, "And Jesus answered and said unto them, Elias truly shall first come and restore all things. But I say unto you that Elias is come already, and they knew him not, but have done with him whatsoever they listed. Likewise shall also the Son of Man suffer of them." Then the disciples understood that he spoke to them of John the Baptist. So this really is suggesting that John the Baptist was a reincarnation of Elias or Elijah. The same theme is echoed in Mark 13 and John. And in John 9, 1-3, the story of the man born blind and the disciples questioning whether it was because of his sin or his parents is certainly a suggestive of a prior life, because if it was born blind, how could it have been his sin unless it had occurred in a pre-existent life? Some modern reincarnationists believe that reincarnation was well accepted at the time of Jesus, but was declared to be a heresy at the time of the 3rd century theologian Origen, who speculated on the pre-existence of the soul. The teachings of Justin Martyr and Jerome are also cited as giving evidence of belief in reincarnation by the early fathers. The advocates of reincarnation accused the early church of censoring the Bible to remove these ideas. Of course, those opposed to this idea can cite evidence opposing the interpretation of the early writings, so it will go on. There's much evidence that Western thinkers continued to speculate on the idea, even though the early church outlawed the doctrine of the preexistence of the soul and reincarnation at the Council of Constantinople in 553. The following quotes are from well-known writers you would probably recognize. "It is the secret of the world that all things subsist and do not die, but only retire a little from sight and afterward return again. Jesus is not dead. He is very well alive, nor John, nor Paul, nor Muhammad, nor Aristotle. At times we believe we have seen them all and could easily tell the names under which they go." That's from Ralph Waldo Emerson. "I lived in Judea 1,800 years ago, but I never knew that there was such a one as Christ among my contemporaries." This is written by Henry David Thoreau. "If we could see ourselves and other objects as they really are, we would see ourselves in a world of spiritual natures, our community with which neither began at our birth nor will end with the death of the body." That's Immanuel Kant. "Why should it be thought incredible that the same soul should inhabit in succession an infinite number of mortal bodies? Even during this one life, our bodies are perpetually changing, though by a process of decay and restoration, which is so gradual that it escapes our notice. Every human being thus dwells successively in many bodies, even during one short life." That's by Francis Bowen. "I am as certain that I have been here before as I now am 1,000 years. I am certain that I have been here before as I am now 1,000 times before, and I hope to return 1,000 times. Man is the dialogue between God and nature. On other planets, this dialogue will doubtless be of a higher and profounder character. What is lacking is self-knowledge. After that, the rest will follow." That's by Van Gogh. Okay. More recently, the New Age teachers have joined the ranks, and the media has featured a variety of stories describing instances of past life recall and spontaneous regression. And belief in reincarnation in some form has skyrocketed in the Western world. One of the latest books dealing with this subject comes from the well-known author Raymond Moody, whose best-selling book, Life After Life, was an inquiry into near-death experiences. That was in 1975. In a more recent book, Coming Back, published in 1991, he examines critically numerous instances of past life recall he has encountered in his work as a psychotherapist. Okay, that's the history to now, to give you a basis to go on. Now, the parallels between Mormon doctrine and reincarnationist teachings. Let me introduce the subject by saying that there are probably as many variations in reincarnation beliefs as there are differences among the various Christian denominations. Very often, if I say I believe in reincarnation to somebody, they'll say, "Well, don't they believe we come back as cows?" Well, and, you know, there's all kind of things people believe, but that doesn't represent everybody. It only represents certain groups. I've selected parallels which I found in a wide variety of literature written by metaphysical authorities of the various schools of thought on reincarnation. These essentially have been Western writers written for Western audiences. And as such, the teachings have been meshed with the optimism that permeates Western thought. Eastern belief in reincarnation are much more pessimistic in nature. It should also be mentioned that the similarities listed below are generally peculiar to Mormon doctrines, and do not apply to traditional Christianity. In fact, the Mormon doctrine of the preexistence of the spirits is considered anti-Christian by traditional Christians and Jews alike, and is thought to be incompatible with the belief in the resurrection. A Mormon trying to defend his belief and preexistence will find himself using the same references as the reincarnationists use. In the following example, an authoritative statement of Mormon doctrine will be presented first. So in each new subheading, I will give the Mormon doctrine first, and followed by the parallel teaching from reincarnationist literature. My authorities for Mormon doctrine will include Bruce R. McConkie, Joseph Fielding Smith, and Orson F. Whitney, who was an apostle back, I think he was made an apostle in about 1906. For the parallel references from reincarnationists, I will quote from Benjamin Krim, Neville Drury, Van Lee P. Hall, and George W. Meek, and George Williamson, all noted writers on mysticism. And as I said, I have copies of my bibliography if anybody wants to check on this. The immortal elements is the first comparison. And this is from Joseph Fielding Smith, on the teachings of the prophet Joseph Smith. Intelligence is eternal and exists upon a self-existent principle. It is spirit from age to age, and there's no creation about it. All the minds and spirits that God ever sent into the world are susceptible of enlargement. Okay, that's from Joseph Fielding Smith about Joseph Smith. And now, this is from the reincarnationists. Our age is not measured in millions or hundreds of millions of years. All we have accomplished is stored up in ourselves. We are always becoming, for we are part of the immortal elements of existence. I think it's hard to miss the parallel. Eternal progression. Endowed with agency and subject to eternal laws, man began his progression and advancement in the preexistence, his ultimate goal being to attain a state of glory, honor, and exaltation like the Father of Spirits. This gradually unfolding course of advancement and experience, a course that began in past eternity and will continue in future, in ages future, is frequently referred to as a course of eternal progression. That's in McConkie's Mormon Doctrine. Now, the reincarnationist. You are here to learn, to experience, to improve, to progress, for no matter how much of truth we find, the ultimate of truth lies beyond. No matter how much wisdom we achieve, infinite wisdom lies beyond. That's from Hall. Manly P. Hall. Spiritual hierarchy. Among the saints of God, perfect brotherhood and equality in all things does or should exist. There are no low or mean persons. All are the children of a loving Father. All are candidates for salvation. And the Almighty is no respecter of persons. Yet the church is a kingdom, a theocracy, a complex organization operated by many officers serving in diverse capacities. This same system prevails in the heavenly realms. A great celestial hierarchy prevails. God, Elohim, stands at the head with spirits, angels, and exalted personages, each ranking in their perspective, assigned positions, and spheres. This is from McConkie. I'm quite sure he's quoting from Joseph Smith. Elohim is the plural. Now here's from the reincarnationist literature. Elohim is the plural of the Canaanite El, of the Hebrew Eloah. Consequently, its literal meaning is gods. Accordingly, as the prophet pointed out, that's still Mormon literature. I haven't jumped to. Okay. Accordingly, as the prophet pointed out, such Old Testament passages as "In the beginning God or Elohim created the heavens and the earth" should more properly be translated, "In the beginning the head of the gods brought forth the gods, and they created the heavens and the earth." Now this is from Joseph Fielding Smith. on the teachings of the prophet Joseph Smith. Now, here's another quote from our literature. Christ is the master, meaning he stood as a teacher, ruler, and commander. Yet, call me master and lord, you say, well, for so I am. And this is from John's quotation. Joseph Smith often hinted of secret identities. Would to God, brethren, I could tell you who I am. Would to God I could tell you what I know. But you would call it blasphemy, and there are men upon this stand who would want to take my life. That's from the writings of Whitman. The spiritual hierarchy, now here's the reincarnation. I get confused because there's so much alike I can't really tell where one. This is from a writer named Meek. The spiritual hierarchy is made up of 24 beings known as the Elohim, approximately 100 lords of light who are beings of great intelligence and spiritual intention, and Christ, the present world teacher. They are directly involved with the paradise supervisors, made up of tens of thousands of enlightened beings known as masters. The paradise seeker supervisors work with enlightened souls on the mental and causal and celestial planes of consciousness, who in turn make contact with spiritually oriented men and women in their physical bodies in many nations. That's from a writer named Meek. Many of the higher level beings choose to incarnate or take a body at different times in order to perform important missions in the service of mankind. Others contribute through visions as guardian angels and messengers. In a book entitled, can you hear?
Okay. Oh, yeah, I'm just delighted at what you're saying.
Oh, well, okay. In a book entitled Sacred Places of the Lion, the past incarnations of Joseph Smith and Brigham Young are traced. And the author of that book is named Williamson, and as far as I can tell, he had no relationship to the Mormon Church. But he was published, I believe, in Chicago. Joseph Smith, he's writing about Joseph Smith and Brigham Young's prior lives. Joseph Smith, among other incarnations, was, according to this writer, Joseph, who was sold into Egypt, Moses, King David, and Montezuma, the famous Aztec ruler, before coming to Earth to organize the Mormon Church. Now that's pretty good. He's right about that, you know. Joseph Smith was a messenger. Okay. In the same source, we are told that Brigham Young, among other incarnations, was formerly Solomon, Gershom, eldest son of Moses, and Saint Jerome, maker of the Latin version of the Bible known as the Vulgate, before coming to Earth to help organize the Mormon Church. I just drew these things. I don't know them. Okay. But I was impressed with that. Okay. Work. Work's the great... Mrs. Mormon again now. Work is the great basic principle which makes all things possible, both in time and eternity. Men, spirits, and angels, and gods use their physical and mental powers in work. Without work, there would be neither existence, creation, redemption, salvation, or temporal necessities for mortal man. Okay. The doctrine of karma teaches that everything that happens in nature is dominated by the law of cause and effect. The law of cause and effect applied to man, this is from reincarnation, isn't it? We've changed, just in case I missed that. The law of cause and effect applied to man shows that everything that happens to an individual is an aspect of universal justice. Every man is in the place he has earned for himself. Every man is doing the thing he has earned the right to do. No one is suffering for the mistakes of others, but for his own mistakes. The only way to be happy, therefore, is to live well, thus setting in action construct his cycles of cause and effect. If we want to be wise, we must earn wisdom. Every individual who lives in the world is in the place he has earned for himself by his actions in this or previous lives. That's from Manly P. Hall, a very well-known mystical writer. Pre-existence. Now this is back to another subject. The pre-existent life was thus a period, undoubtedly, an infinite long one of probable progression, probation, progression, and schooling. The spirit hosts were taught and given experiences in various administrative capacities. Some so exercised their agency and so conformed to law as to become noble and great. These were foreordained before their mortal birth to perform great missions for the Lord in this life. That's in McConkie's writings. Life is eternal. This is the reincarnation. Life is eternal, and man's appearance upon this earth for 80 years and 10 is but an episode in an existence made up of innumerable episodes. The Orientalist thinks of lives as beads strung together upon a thread of endless consciousness. Life is an endless unfoldment toward the real. It is consciousness growing up through experience with its beginnings in the immeasurable past and its ultimates in the immeasurable future. That's by Manly P. Hall again. Okay, now we're going to another subject, the Spirit of Truth, the Holy Ghost. Okay. The Holy Ghost is the Spirit of Truth, a title signifying that part of his mission is to guide the saints to all truth, and that by his power the truth of all things may be known. That's McConkie. Now, I remember that the Mormon Church does teach the Holy Ghost did not have a body. Now we go to reincarnation literature. The Akashic records are a theosophical concept of an astral memory of all events, thoughts, and emotions that have arisen since the world began. Psychics are said to be able to tune into this dimension and receive authentic impressions of past ages. Some of the theosophical descriptions of Atlantis derive from this technique. So if you read about Atlantis, you're getting it from this, people who claim to read the Akasha. And that's from Drury. Okay, now to immortality. Immortality is to live forever in the resurrected state with body and spirit inseparably connected. The Lord's work and glory is to bring to pass both immortality and eternal life of man. That's McConkie. Now, it would be wrong to say that physical immortality is probable or even possible for the average person in the modern world. We believe that something resembling physical immortality has been accomplished by the great adepts and initiates who have mastered the secrets of life. But their accomplishment in no way justifies ordinary men and women in expecting eternal youth. So it's for those who have great accomplishments, that's Hall. The master's consciousness includes the consciousness of the spiritual plane. He has spiritualized his body of manifestation and no longer needs to incarnate on this planet, except by choice to serve the plan. He may be asked to do so by the Lord of the world as part of the plan. That's by Benjamin Krim. Okay, now for families are forever. We are taught that families are meant to be forever, and our most sacred ceremonies are reserved for binding in heaven what is bound on earth. One of the curious things I have noticed about the sealing ceremony is that we are not promised eternal life, but eternal lives. Have any of you noticed this? Reincarnationists speak of twin souls. This is, again, we're moving to Benjamin Krim. Reincarnationists speak of twin souls and soulmates and believe that where enlightened souls choose to incarnate together over and over in order to accomplish their goals or their karmic destiny. They may come together as marriage partners, brothers, sisters, or friends. The average man is magnetically drawn into incarnation by his desire nature, by that which held him to earth. The strands or ties of karma, the effect of cause and effects, which we have set in motion, create groupings, family and wider groupings, which necessitate group incarnation to work out and resolve. And that's Krim. However, freedom of choice always seems to be present in making decisions of this nature. Many parallels could be cited, but I think this is sufficient to make the point. Problems and conflicts. The official church position on this issue has been ambiguous over the years. Or, according to Quinn's most recent historical publication, on April 14, 1898, this matter was considered by the First Presidency and the Apostles. He tells us they discussed an alleged belief of some elders in the doctrine of reincarnation. The conclusion reached was that every elder's right to believe what seemed right to him should be respected, and no actions should be taken against him while he refrained from teaching his view to others and respected and upheld the authority vested in the presiding priesthood. This was referring to a local bishop named Orson F. Whitney. In 1906, Whitney was ordained an apostle. So that was about 8 years later. So his beliefs obviously didn't hold him back in the church. In 1966, however, McConkie tells us in his book Mormon Doctrine that reincarnation, or the transmigration of souls, the belief, rebirth of the same spirits in new bodily forms in successive ages, is a false doctrine originating with the devil. He cites an incident in the life of Joseph Smith as the final word on this position. The incident he cites is discussed in the teachings of the prophet Joseph Smith. It seems a Jewish minister named Joshua showed up at the prophet's home, and for the next several days they discussed and exchanged ideas. However, during the visit, it was learned that this minister was the notorious Matthias of New York, who had spent time in prison for murder, manslaughter, and child beating. After these facts were learned about him, he made the claim that he was the transmigrated soul of the apostle Matthias, who was appointed to replace Judas after the betrayal. He also claimed to have the soul of Christ. After a few days, Joseph Smith told him that his God was of the devil and asked him to leave. And to quote, "And so I, for once, cast out the devil in bodily shape, and I believe a murderer." Okay. So, was he saying that reincarnation was wrong, or was he saying this man was of the devil? That's the question you have to ask yourself. This seems to be the only statement Joseph Smith made on the subject, and I find the story somewhat ambiguous. Was this man cast up because of his teaching about transmigration, or because it was learned that he was a murderer? If Joseph Smith was secretly espousing the doctrine of reincarnation, as my research suggests, we may well ask why his statements on the subject remain so vague. Why didn't he just come right out with it? The answer very well be fear. His controversial teachings had gotten him in trouble wherever he went. This was something he taught at Nauvoo, by the way. I didn't see anything before that. This doctrine had been proscribed by Christianity since 553 AD and still remains a controversial topic. Perhaps fearing more persecution, he chose to reveal this tenet in more oblique ways to be made clear as people were more ready to accept it. Conclusions. Can a belief in reincarnation be reconciled with Mormon doctrine? I will leave each of you to answer this question for yourself. I find it safer to remain tentative about controversial subjects. This is the motto I have adopted. Keeps me out of trouble. Don't bother to agree with me, I've already changed my mind. This philosophy makes it much easier for me to change my mind. After all, if you don't have an open mind, there's really no room for any new information, is there? I've enjoyed presenting these concepts for your consideration. Since opinion polls seem to indicate that the idea of reincarnation is growing in popularity all the time, I think it would be premature for any of us to come to a definite conclusion one way or the other. If we keep our minds open, we'd be better prepared to accept what the future reveals. Well, it looks like we have time for questions. Yeah.
I hate mine.
Well, sorry, but they want this on the tape, and I do too.
Okay.
I'm not sure what I'm going to say, but at any rate, just a comment. Reading a lot of near-death experience literature, and it seems like the people who have these experiences, their take on death is that the purpose of life is to learn and to love. And it just seemed reasonable to me that one life doesn't seem to be enough to accomplish that goal. It seems whether it's on this earth or whether it's in another sphere, we'll need to have a lot more time to learn in some other mode, because it seems we are slow learners to me. But my question is then, from you, I would understand from your talk that reincarnation is a belief that is satisfying to you in the form of explaining why things happen to you, that it's not an angry God. So in what ways to you, can you explain a little more, maybe I didn't get it, what ways to you is it a satisfying belief? What questions does it resolve for you?
Well, it's perfectly obvious as a therapist, I spent 16 years and just living, that everybody's not getting the same treatment, the same breaks, whatever, it just isn't. Some people live long and some people die as infants. My daughter died at age 4. I need to feel justice, and this makes justice come from me. This is justice, because if you don't accomplish it now, you're going to have another turn, and you just keep trying until you do. And the chance of becoming an immortal being exists. You've got to work for it. Anybody else now?
I'm always surprised by those people who are shocked by reincarnation and think it's such a far-out concept. But they can believe in immaculate conception. They can believe in being raised from the dead and ascending into heaven. They're all difficult things to believe, and they're all easy to believe, just depending on your point of view. And I just think we haven't heard the word reincarnation often enough in our lives, most of us growing up in the West.
I agree. And an awful lot of it is learning to understand what that meaning was. I mean, you read something, you don't understand what they meant, and you interpret it the way you heard it in Sunday school, and then you say, well, this doesn't make any sense to me. But when you really get to the depths, things do make sense. Very good sense. At least they do to me. But I have a lot more questions. Anyone else want to comment or ask questions? We have time, so you ask what you see.
It was always taught to me that, I'm sorry that I came in late. It was taught to me that the Roman Catholics earlier did have a belief in reincarnation, and it was also taught to me by people that dug in the early day journals of the church that Joseph and the early day brethren had a belief in it too. And in one journal, it writes about these little children being very, very upset because the prophet was laying on the couch, the prophet Joseph was laying on the couch, and the children were told not to, and it looked like he was dead, and it was told to the children, do not fear, brother Joseph is just having an out-of-body experience. Well, I too believe that we can't become goddesses and gods in one turn of the crank. I don't believe that. And the more I've opened up, and after I've been visiting other bookstores, it's come to me as an absolute truth that it's a glorious thing. One of my children wrote me a letter not so long ago and told me that he was living the life of a gay person, and I just didn't think I was ever going to get over this, but I have, and he's taught me so many things. And so in this probation, possibly this is his choice. In this probation, I choose to be an enlightened woman and thank the church for all the good things it taught me, but I know there's more. And just recently, I picked up a couple of books, and they are called Conversations with God, and they're on the bestseller list, and they're extraordinary. It's about a man who is absolutely fed up with his life and his relationships, no abundance, just absolutely grinding along from month to month trying to make ends meet. And so he decided to write a letter to the greatest victimizer of them all, namely God. And he wrote this on a fool's cap sheet and finished it with great flourish and anger. And suddenly a force took over his pen, and the writing said, are you just venting or do you really want some answers? And out of this letter writing came the most wonderful discourse between a man and God. And this God also has some very female aspects too. These two books have surely changed my life, and I just want to warn you, there's going to be book three. So there's one and two on the market right now, on the bestseller list throughout the world, where so much sense is being revealed. And Joseph Smith wasn't too far wrong in some aspects, and he had some great gifts of communing with the other side, automatic writing, revelatory powers. But we need to remember that we came here with those same powers. We just have to uncover them. And I just want to say, if you want to have a thrill and get some things squared away, if you're having a lot of questions, Conversations reveals that, yes, you did have several lives. The man's name is Neil Donald Walsh. And he said, you mean I lived before? Yes, you've had hundreds of lives. And in some of those lives, you were this, you were that, you were a king. You even had a duel, and you even killed someone for a lady's hand. You were even a fool in one of your probations. But, you know, I wish that I could give you, I'm going to stop now, I wish I could tell you where in the early Mormon doctrine they truly did believe this, but now we're suffering from doctrinal fade-out. We don't teach these things anymore. We just have pablum. But thank you very much for this time.
Is it, what's our time like?
Almost done. 10 minutes.
That was my cue, doctrinal fade out. I don't know what to say, but having heard that, something, surely something more can be said along these lines. It seems to me, we're here at an academic symposium about Mormonism, and it's an oxymoron, isn't it? Because my experience of Mormonism was one of mysticism, and a means and a method to transcend and to touch that which is true. And I feel frustration here at an academic forum where we have liberal Mormons who I once thought would be supportive of ideas that were spiritual in nature, and I have unfortunately come to find that, in fact, the tone is one of antagonism towards spirituality. And that's been a surprise to me, and so I have been afraid to raise my voice in this setting. But I'll raise my voice just a little now and say I applaud this subject. I find it to be an important question. Have we lived before? Of course we have. That's my testimony. I don't have a testimony the church is true. I've always had a testimony that the gospel of Jesus Christ is true.
Should be on the tape.
You can all take our masks off.
I don't have to wear a mask. I'm not a member. But I think the term that's been used on the internet lately about this is multiple mortal probations. Is that the correct term? which according to the Encyclopedia of Mormonism, doesn't exist. The term isn't anywhere in there. I looked. Again, this streamlining and trimming of Mormon doctrine. But here's my question. If we've lived before many hundreds of times, and if the purpose of living again and again is to get it right, why haven't we gotten it right? When I read the newspaper, I realize that we haven't come close to getting where we need to be. What's going on? Of course I want you to answer it.
Well, I think a lot of people have gotten it right, but then when they get it right, they're transcendent. So they're not with us anymore. They can't stand us. That's my feeling. Who would stay here unless they came back on a special mission like Jesus Christ or Joseph or Brigham Young or heaven knows how many others? But they certainly wouldn't stick around if they're all trained for this. Okay.
I have a comment on
come,
that.
Come here.
The reason I think we keep coming back, or coming back to some other world, is so that we can learn to be like God. If you come back as a king one time and a pauper one time, somebody in India one time, for example, then you have empathy for that life and for those people. How else are you going to help? How else are you going to create if you can't understand what they are going through? Maybe one time you're handicapped, and maybe one time you're a teacher. But each time you learn how those people feel. And God must know how we all feel if he can help us in our lives. And maybe if we are ever going to become gods and goddesses, I don't know if we are, but if we are, we would have to have those experiences.
We're having me.
In a sense, this is a concept of universality, you know, very much like Ralph Waldo Emerson. What I would like to say is the way I solved this for myself is was an interesting experience. I went to someone, they said, oh, yes, in your pre-existence, you were a Chinese princess and you were not a touchable person. And all of a sudden, the pieces in my life fell together for some strange reason. What I feel now, my answer was, yes, that probably as a pre-existent spirit, I came to minister to others and to support others in their earth life. And that certainly for this Chinese spirit, that spirit was strong and left imprints on me personally in some way. And since then, I have served BYU in China as a China teacher and gone back several times. Something about China is you don't go back unless you are really dedicated. And so I feel pulled there by this spirit. I believe in ministering angels, and I do believe in the plan of progression. I joined the church when I was 23 in Pennsylvania, and both prophets and the sense of oneness on earth have been a great blessing to me.
If any of you have feel you have to leave, it's okay.
Hi, I'm curious. Have you looked at all at Egyptian, ancient Egyptian,
and
the Gnostics and that sort of stuff?
He asked if I looked into Egyptian. I started this particular journey in 1960. That is 37 years. I have delved into Hinduism, the Egyptians, and I'm not bragging. I'm just telling you, this has been a long journey, and you never run out of places to go. And every time you come to something like this, I say, well, here's a book you've got to read. So I have a library. Very definitely, he and Nibley, I went to him privately to try and help me understand the temple ceremony better. And he pulled out the Egyptian Book of the Dead and told me about their ceremony. And he didn't say any more, but it certainly gave me the message.
I just want to thank you so much for having the courage, you know, to step forth in an intellectual group and to bring forth your experiences. And I attended one of her other lectures yesterday, and I just wanted to sow a few little seeds here. Isn't it exciting that we're on the threshold of a graduation? And many of us who have come many times to work with humanity, to raise the consciousness, and we recognize who we are and why we have come. And then, as the veil is being lifted at this time, and we come into groups, and we look into each other's eyes, and there is a knowing within us that we have known each other sometime before. And it's exciting as I've met Helen and many others who've come into my life. And we have this deep, abiding love that we can't deny. And so we throw our arms about each other and we embrace each other once again. And I awakened in 1991. And since that time, it's been a wonderful journey remembering. And that's one of the things that this beautiful book that Helen has told us about today is, because our cells, our DNA, everything about us is remembering those times here upon this earth as well as on many other earths as well. And I look about you today, and I want to tell you what a beautiful aura that you have. Her aura is blue, beautiful blue on her head. And around the rest of her body is pink, which is a beautiful color of love. Like I say, I awakened in 1991 after having a near-death experience. And a lot of people didn't understand some of the things that were coming to me at that time. As we're awakened. But a wonderful friend came to me who was a writer, and as I told her how I felt as I came out of that cocoon, that she wrote this little piece for me. May I share it? And then I'll sit down.
Okay.
Because you might identify with this as well. Well, here I am, just out of the old cocoon. Let's see. Legs are working. Wings are drying. Sensors sensing. Ah, what now? What now after that dreaming, changing sleep? What now? Funny, I'd always picture myself a butterfly tough, having discarded the notion that I was a hummingbird fragile. But recently discovering that I was, for all those years, a voracious, starving, caterpillar thing in a rampant hurry to be fed. And when I'd eaten all I could, and when I got all wrapped up in myself, They tried to pull me out by acting, saying, do, I do, act please, act now. Oh, it was kindly, of course. But I had wisdom to resist and waited wisely time. And act, I will. But don't call upon the caterpillar. It is gone. Know me now and then ask. Thank you so much.
Okay, I just have a question. Was there a pre-existence? In relation to the whole idea of reincarnation, was there ever a pre-existence where we were in a spirit form and we had an identity? I mean, like, we have several times according to reincarnation, and then is there ever an identity that we will assume indefinitely at some point? That's my question.
Well, as far as was there ever a pre-existence of matter and intelligence, according to the prophet, has always existed. So we always existed in some form. Everything exists, it just changes. Will we ever assume an identity and keep it? That's when you're supposed to ascend, as Jesus did, and when your body and spirit are inseparably connected forever, if you choose to. Or if you choose to come back and do a mission, that could happen too. You're not going to be held. You always make your own decisions in this philosophy. Nobody makes them for you.